Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Cities and companies make substantial investments in signs and design. Since 1999, Louisville's Downtown Development Corporation and the city have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on signage aimed at helping people navigate downtown by vehicle and on foot. That investment is part of the movement of information design, which was a topic last week of a talk by Joel Katz. He founded Joel Katz Design Associates in Philadelphia. He's worked on creating direction or wayfinding systems in Philadelphia and Portland, Oregon, and his work has been recognized by the Society for Environmental Graphic Design. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Katz about why the design of information on everything from roadside signs to labels on medications is increasingly important in modern-day life.
What is information design?
Well, information design is design that puts the communication of information, presumably important information, often complex information, above, you know, formal aesthetics and above persuasion. So persuasion generally has an advertising bent, and graphic design very often has a lot of formal and cosmetic aspects that are sometimes placed by the designer as being more important than the message.
What are some notable examples of good information design?
Wow. There are a lot of wayfinding programs that are very good information design. The reason it's important is because there's so much bad information design out there. And in addition to the work we do ourselves, I'm teaching a course at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia that I started this year, where teams of students take examples of bad information design that could have a very important negative political, health, safety kind of impact. For example, one team is redesigning the voting machine graphics in Philadelphia. Another is redoing the Tylenol packaging. A third is doing what used to be called the food pyramid, which is now a joke. So they're dealing with all the issues of explaining nutrition to a mass audience. Another group is doing the sheets that you get from the pharmacy when you buy a prescription drug, some of which can have very negative or even fatal impact. And a fifth, which is not a health and safety issue, but it's a source of great frustration to everyone, are trying to make sense out of the packages that cable and satellite TV offer.
And what are some of the characteristics that makes good information design?
A consistent, universally understandable vocabulary, both a visual vocabulary and a verbal vocabulary, because these students are rewriting things as well. Consistency and clarity of formal elements, creation of a rational information hierarchy. In other words, making the most important things most easily visible and perceivable.
Can you give me a real-life example of that, of what people might recognize?
It's easier to come up with bad examples than good examples because the bad examples are what people are familiar with. If you've ever gone into a pharmacy chain because you want Tylenol, you know, there are 30 different kinds of Tylenol. It's very, 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 very hard to understand the differences among them. And so you could end up wasting a lot of time, getting a lot of frustration, and possibly buying the wrong thing just because you want to get out of there. That's a very, very ready example of information design that can improve everybody's experience with a product purchase.
You also deal with information in terms of directions.
I do.
And how that works. What are some places where it works really well and is very informational to people, but at the same time appealing without that appeal getting in the way of the message?
Clarity is its own kind of beauty. And, you know, I'm very pleased with the work I did, and I know of other excellent work by other designers, but I can't cite them off the top of my head. There are a number of information designers in New York that do very good work. 212 Associates is an example. There are a number of information design firms out on the West Coast that do very good work. And part of the problem is anything that starts out as a specialty comes into the mainstream. There's a very, very large possibility that it will be misunderstood and practiced in a way no better than where things started out. I just answered a request for a proposal from a small town in North Carolina, because wayfinding is kind of a hot topic, and a lot of towns and cities believe that it will help their tourist industry. And the firm that got the job does horrible, horrible stuff where it looks like a suburban subdivision on a stone base. And so people think that they're clarifying themselves and developing a program and a brand that will help people find their way around, when in fact a lot of it is just very, very superficial and doesn't work very well.
Well, how has wayfinding information and other types changed in recent decades? Has there been any large shifts?
More and more urban environments and academic environments are aware of it. And those that can understand it, that know what they're doing, perceive it as a way to ameliorate people's interaction with their environment, especially if it's a strange environment. And then there are those that are just kind of riding in the coattails and really don't understand what's going on, and they hire designers who don't really understand what's going on. So that's the way it's evolved. But it's a relatively new phenomenon, and the good wayfinding design projects can have a significant impact in reducing frustration and saving people's time and reducing anxiety. So when you do that, you have an overall, you know, environmental enhancement when anxiety is reduced and fear is reduced and all the things that are associated with finding your way around a complicated environment.
Do you think that's more important today in today's society?
Yes, I do. Cities are getting bigger and more complex. Travel is accessible to more and more people, but language barriers put a limit on it and a cap on it. I'm speaking without specific reference to the current world economic slowdown. But yeah, I think it helps bring people together and helps universal understanding. It's not a cure for cancer, but it is a good thing. And European countries and cities, especially those in the Low Countries and Scandinavia, have really been in the forefront of it.
Thanks a lot for your time.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for calling.
That was WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer speaking with Joel Katz, a specialist in information design, who was at U of L's Cressman Center for Visual Art last week. The December 2008 coal ash spill at a power plant in Tennessee buried nearly 300 acres under thick black sludge. It also left many asking how such a disaster could have happened. Now, as U.S. lawmakers push for answers, WFPL's Kristen Espelon finds out who's watching coal ash in Kentucky.
Coal ash is just what it sounds like. It's the leftovers from burning coal at a power plant. LG&E's Cane Run plant in southwest Louisville burns 1.5 million tons of coal a year, leaving about 150,000 tons of ash behind. The powdery fly ash is blended into a kind of cement and landfilled on site. The heavier bottom ash goes in this pond.
This is bottom ash.
Engineer Jeff Hune stoops on the shores of this man-made pond, teeming with geese. He sifts some bottom ash that's washed ashore. Behind him stand several modest houses, a road and railroad tracks. At the other end of the pond, plant manager Stephen Turner points to a small gate that lets water drain continuously into the Ohio River. Millions of gallons a year pour through it to keep the pond from overflowing.
We do have kind of a trap system here, so that only water flows out through the discharge.
Turner says they monitor that outflow water for certain contaminants, but LG&E's state permit allows a certain amount in every liter.
The resulting ash from burning coal contains trace metals such as arsenic, lead, mercury, cadmium, selenium, and other dangerous chemicals.
Lisa Evans is an attorney for Earth Justice. She specializes in hazardous waste law.
And it has to be handled very carefully so that those chemicals don't re-escape.
She says safety standards vary by state and by plant, so
the problem is that there are no federal regulations that provide minimum standards for how this waste is disposed. So it's up to each plant to decide how they want to handle the waste. There are some state regs, but they tend to be very lax.
That lack of oversight caught lawmakers' attention this month at a hearing before the U.S. House Natural Resources Committee. Kentucky Resources Council head Tom Fitzgerald testified. In this exchange, Fitzgerald and coal industry executive Nick Akins spar over whether the ash should be regulated like any other hazardous waste.
And I think there really is a need to go back and revisit whether these should be regulated as hazardous waste.
We do not believe it should be as a hazardous waste because obviously the EPA has looked at this several times and determined that it's not a hazardous waste.
That's partly true. In 2000, the Environmental Protection Agency ruled that waste from coal combustion wasn't hazardous, which means it didn't have to be handled according to federal guidelines. But in 2007, an EPA investigation found 24 cases where coal ash had already damaged water quality and ecosystem health. The problems were mostly found in unlined ponds seeping into groundwater. More than 180 unlined ponds have been identified throughout the country. LG&E engineer Jeff Hune says the 55-year-old Cane Run Plants pond is probably not lined either.
As far as what's underneath the pond bottom, we're not sure. Just knowing the natural topography, there's clayey soils and sandy soils in this area.
That means there's a chance that water could be seeping out. Although the groundwater here doesn't feed the neighborhood's drinking water supply, it does feed the region's watershed. LG&E does monitor the groundwater for contaminants, but the state doesn't require them to. Assistant head of the Kentucky Division of Water, Pete Goodman, says that as far as groundwater goes statewide, no one really has a handle on the potential impacts.
There really isn't a groundwater permit program in the Division of Water. Actually, any injection issues on groundwater issues are handled primacy is through EPA. So to some degree, it may be falling between the regulatory cracks.
While Congress and state legislators continue to debate how to handle coal ash and who should oversee it, Cane Run's ash pond has almost reached capacity, and they'll need another on-site landfill soon. Industry and environmental groups alike say the best option is landfills rather than ponds, but an even better option is to reuse the ash in products like cement. LG&E's Stephen Turner says they sell what they can.
We do utilize bottom ash in beneficial reuse projects. Some bottom ash from LG&E has been used to build the Greenbelt Highway.
But fly ash is a tougher sell here.
The market has just not been developed in the United States. In Europe, there is regulation that requires use of these byproducts.
The idea is catching on in the U.S., but not enough to keep up with the more than 130 million tons of coal ash produced here every year. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Still to come, Susan Sweeney Crum investigates angels with author Dr. Sue Garrett. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Touched by an Angel. Angels and Demons, the Angel Gabriel. Whether it's television, movies, or the Bible, references to angels aren't hard to find. It was, in fact, the growth in recent years of angels and pop culture that prompted a local author and professor to write her latest book, taking a closer look at the belief in angels, the nature of God's presence in the world, and the fate of humans after death. WFPL's Susan Sweeney Crum spoke with Dr. Sue Garrett, a New Testament professor with the Louisville Presbyterian Theological Seminary, about her book, No Ordinary Angel.
Dr. Sue Garrett, you have written your latest book is, you say, just a little different from, I guess, some of the ones you've written previously. And it's No Ordinary Angel, essentially a book about angels. How did you come to this?
Well, I've been interested in early Christian beliefs about spirits and demons and angels for a really long time. I actually wrote a couple of other books that had quite a bit to do with early beliefs about the devil. So it was a sort of natural transition to come over to talking about angels. What's different about this book is that I'm not simply focusing on the first century and ancient beliefs. I'm also talking about what people today believe about angels and even about what people down through the history of the Christian church have believed about angels.
Because we hear a lot about angels in the last several years, and you kind of refer to that as you start your book. It's they've kind of had this little resurgence or this new attention. It seems new anyway.
Well, angels have always been really popular. There have been peaks and valleys in the interest in angels, and I think you're right. We've been through a time recently where there's been an exceptional degree of interest in angels, and that's really what got me interested in writing about this topic. I was fascinated by the range of movies and television shows and books of all different theological varieties that were coming out. And I thought, what's going on here? And how does this relate to what early Christians said about angels?
Mm-hmm. Did you, as you started it, was it your intention or did it just happen? Or were you approaching it, because you're a professor of New Testament, were you approaching it from a Christian point of view, or just were you open to whatever you found as you went along?
Well, I am a Christian. I teach at the Presbyterian Seminary, Louisville Presbyterian Seminary. I'm a Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. So I do approach it as a believing Christian, but I'm very open to the range of ways that people have talked about angels through the centuries. And of course, although I don't really focus on other religions in the book, it is the case that people of a number of different religions have believed in spirits or angels. So I'm approaching it as a Christian, but I'm very interested in what ancient Jews believed about angels. And I'm interested today in what some spiritual movements, which maybe wouldn't identify as Christian, what might be called New Age Christian or New Age belief, for example, what they might say about angels. So I'm really looking at the whole range of current belief in the United States and in Western culture, aside from, say, Islamic belief. I don't really touch on that.
Now, anyone familiar with the New Testament would know the ancient angel Gabriel and the archangel and Michael. And I can't think right off the top of my head. I think of visions and dreams and appearances and God approaching people in the Old Testament. Were there angel appearances in the Old Testament?
In the Old Testament? Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, yes. In fact, the appearances that are described in the New Testament are really in continuity with the very rich tradition in the Old Testament. So Gabriel appears in the New Testament, but he also appears in the book of Daniel. Michael appears in the book of Daniel. Those are the only two named angels in the Old Testament. In the apocryphal books, there is one other angel. Raphael is mentioned in the apocryphal book of Tobit. That's a book that Catholics believe it to be scripture, but Protestants don't deem it scriptural. But then there are many unnamed angels throughout the Old Testament. The most significant set of traditions revolve around a figure called the Angel of the Lord, who appears a number of times in Genesis and in other books of the Old Testament. Really quite a significant figure that I believe had a very profound influence on later beliefs about angels and how they developed over the centuries, and probably even some influence on the way beliefs about Jesus developed in the early years of the Christian church.
Is that angel of the Lord always one particular angel, or is that a reference to a type of angel? I mean, do you believe that to be
a single angel?
Yeah.
That's a great question. It's kind of hard to answer. It's sort of complicated because the evidence is that in the earliest depictions, it may have been simply a kind of role, so an angel of the Lord. But certainly as the centuries passed, Jews and then Christians in their turn began to think of this as a very specific angel, what I call the chief cook and bottle washer angel, the head of all the angels. But there was difference of opinion about who it was. Some Jews believed that Michael was the angel of the Lord, and others said Gabriel. And then this figure is given yet other names in other non-biblical ancient traditions.
Would there be a reason that certain angels would be named, Gabriel and Michael and Raphael? Are they more important angels? I mean,
it's so much that they're more important. They're later in the tradition. So the places where the angels are unnamed and where the angel of the Lord appears, say, in Genesis, those are older traditions. But then beginning maybe in the 3rd century BCE, maybe even a little earlier than that, probably in part due to cultural influences from outside traditions, Persian influence, for example, there begins to be a great escalation in interest in angels, and this is when we start to see named angels. And although there are only 3 named in the biblical tradition, if you count Raphael, in other non-canonical Jewish traditions, there are many, many other named angels. But they're all from this later period, say from the 3rd century BCE up through the New Testament period.
So what do you find today, and how did you approach this in terms of angels that are here today?
Well, I'm really interested in what other things people might be talking about when they talk about angels. One of my basic working assumptions in the book is that when people talk about angels, they're often talking about other things as well. So they may be talking, for example, about whether and how we can come into God's presence, or whether and how God heals us when we're in need of healing, or whether and how God is present with us at the time of death, or whether and how God is present with us or perhaps interacting with us in times of trial and temptation. And angels are a useful way for people to talk about these other kinds of questions. God isn't visible to us, but at least in tradition, angels are often visible. They even converse with people. And so talking about angels is a way to get at, I think, these other kinds of somewhat more difficult questions. So in the book, I'm really looking at I'm trying to sort of go beneath the surface and see, okay, if people are talking about angels, then is it possible they're also talking about some of these other questions? And in fact, I find that they are talking about healing or divine presence or temptation or whether God helps us when we're in time of trouble and whether God's present with us at death.
Do people know if they're, when you say we even talk to angels, do we know that at the time or do we figure it out, or
of different beliefs about that. There are certainly people who would claim, and I've spoken to many people who would claim that they have spoken to angels, or that angels have spoken to them, either in some kind of mystical appearance, or in a dream, or simply in their head. But they are convinced that this was an angelic epiphany, and others would say they don't know. Mm-hmm. And I think the question of how angels appear to people, or whether they appear at all, has to do a lot with how people are raised, the kind of tradition they're brought up in. There are some traditions historically and even today which are more inclined to claim that angels appear. Historically, Catholicism has been more congenial to claims of angelic appearance and presence than has Protestantism. So, for example, belief in guardian angels is much more at home in Catholic thought than it is in Protestant thought.
Are there bad angels, or would there be, I mean, Satan himself is a fallen angel. Do they then become a different term, or are there bad angels out there?
Today, most people tend to think of angels as good and benign or helpful or pleasant. But certainly in the biblical tradition, there are angels who are less reliable in that way, angels who are going to create problems for people. In one of the most famous passages in the New Testament, at the end of Romans 8, when Paul talks about how nothing can separate us from God's love, one of the things he lists as unable to separate us from God's love is angels. Which suggests he thinks that there might be angels who would try to separate us from God's love. And in the biblical era, there is a very rich and varied tradition of angels who went astray from God's will and who made trouble for people and who tried to keep people from being faithful to God in one way or another. So Satan is one of those, but apart from Satan, there are many other angels in both the biblical and in the non-biblical, but sort of traditions related to the Bible, where there are angels depicted who are seen to be malevolent.
After finishing your book and with all the research and conversations, did you come away with any new ideas or different thinking at all, or did it confirm or affirm?
It gave me all kinds of new ideas. This was really an adventure for me. It was a book 10 years in the writing, and I learned an incredible amount writing it. It really took me outside my own expertise, which is in New Testament studies, into Old Testament studies, into the history of the development of Western theology in the Western Church, into much of popular culture that I didn't really know anything about beforehand. So I learned a great deal about many different topics. And I was fascinated, I think probably above all, by the explorations I did concerning how early beliefs about angels might have helped to shape early beliefs about Jesus. It's very interesting that New Testament writers, particularly the writer of the letter to the Hebrews, are adamant that Jesus is not an angel. That's very important for them to assert. But at the same time, they often talk about Jesus in ways that closely resemble the way ancient authors were talking about angels. People believed that angels were mediators between humanity and God. And of course, that's what we think of Jesus as, the great mediator between humans and God, indeed as God. There are also ways in which they describe the appearance of Jesus as resembling the appearance of angels. In Revelation chapter 1, for example, the risen Lord is described in ways that very much evoke the angel Gabriel in the 10th chapter of Daniel. And Paul talks about Jesus as the glory of the Lord in a way that very much resembles the way the glory of the Lord is described in Ezekiel 1, a passage that was itself influenced by beliefs about angels. So people are thinking about Jesus and they're thinking about angels. And although they want to say that Jesus was not an angel, at the same time, they go to language about angels in order to talk about who Jesus was. And I found that very exciting, a kind of new way into understanding how the earliest ideas about Jesus developed.
This sounds like this book can also, obviously, for a person who's reading it of various backgrounds, will take a lot of new perspective as well.
I hope so. And I hope that people will be, I believe that people will be very interested in particularly my forays into popular culture. I talk about everything from the CBS television show Touched by an Angel to the whole range of movies that have come out, to New Age beliefs about angels, to evangelical Christian beliefs about spiritual warfare and how Christians battle against demons and fallen angels. And so there's a little something in there for everyone, and I hope that people will find that intriguing, as it certainly intrigued me as I was working on it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Garrett.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Sue Garrett has also taught at Yale Divinity School and Emory University, and she is coordinator of the Louisville Grawemeyer Award in Religion. Coming up next, Gabe Bullard talks with Kentucky-based author Charles Braceland Flood about the challenges faced by the nation and Abraham Lincoln in the tumultuous year of 1864. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. The year 1864 was to Abraham Lincoln what 1776 was to George Washington. Whereas Washington led his rebels in the creation of the United States, Lincoln fought rebels to keep the states united. Lincoln also faced rivals off the battlefield as he fought to win re-election to the presidency. Charles Braceland Flood, who is based in Kentucky, has published a book called 1864, Lincoln at the Gates of History. He writes about the challenges Lincoln and the nation faced that year. Flood spoke with WFPL's Gabe Bullard.
How did you come about to decide 1864 was the year you wanted to write about?
Well, the more I looked at it, I felt that with the possible exception of 1776, that's the only competition, this was the critical year in the nation's history. And looking back on it, people say, well, of course we won the Civil War and the North won the Civil War. Of course Lincoln was reelected. But it didn't look like that at all as 1864 began. And the South was inflicting horrendous casualties on the North and was going to do even more of that in Northern Virginia later in the year. A large body of opinion among the Democrats were ready to try to have a negotiated peace, you know, which would have left the Confederacy as a separate nation with slavery intact. And even as late as late August of that year, Lincoln was of the opinion that he was not going to be reelected.
And speaking of Lincoln's election, you make the point he was facing some competition on both sides here from people he had worked with. There was Chase was running as
right.
Secretary of Treasury, and yep. also McClellan.
Yes, it was very, very interesting. Chase, in particular, this was his Secretary of the Treasury, who in 1860, along with William H. Seward, both looked as if they would be much more likely to be elected, but somehow Lincoln slipped through. Chase thought this had all been a terrible mistake. He settled for being Secretary of the Treasury, but he never gave up the idea that he was going to be the nominee in 1864. And Lincoln outmaneuvered him, as he did so many people. Chase was doing a very good job in a very complicated financial situation of the North, coming very close to running out of money to prosecute this war that seemed to be at a stalemate. And at a certain point, Chase offered his resignation, thinking that Lincoln would have to back down, and Lincoln accepted his resignation, and then Chase really was out.
In 1864, with the election, at the time that the citizens were going to vote, how big of a factor was the war in helping or hurting Lincoln in the opinion of the war?
Excellent question. Definitely the election of Lincoln, what he faced, would be a referendum on how the war was going. And what really turned everything around was that a week after he made the statement flatly that he thought he was going to be beaten unless something greatly changed, Sherman, who'd been making his march through Georgia, but nobody really knew how that was going, he sent the telegram from Atlanta saying, Atlanta is ours and fairly won. And that's what changed everything, is that then even the most ardent Confederate could see that Atlanta, the second most important city in the Confederacy and dead center in Confederate territory, had fallen to the Union. The North had, many in the North had lost hope. That hope was revitalized. And although there were some weeks before the election and some more fighting, that's what coasted Lincoln on in.
You talk about the importance of the year politically, but also, as you just mentioned, with Sherman's march, this was kind of the turning point for the war as well.
It certainly was. And Grant has been a little bit unfairly characterized as just this bulldog who only prevailed over Robert E. Lee because he had more men. The fact is that a succession of Union commanders had failed against Lee, having just as many more men as Grant did. And so Grant, who had really was a man for the war of movement, as he had proved in the Western theater, was brought east. He slugged it out with Lee, but both of them were, their best talents weren't being used when this precursor of World War I trench warfare was going on around Richmond and Petersburg, but they both were locked there through geographical and political considerations, and Lee, in fact, thought that Grant was doing a good job, and he knew that Grant was going to work his way around him and finally break him, but as Lee later said of the Confederates, they had to find out for themselves, which is kind of an interesting thing, but his idea was he had his orders and he was just going to fight to the end.
What difficulties did Lincoln face in choosing to appoint Grant as the General-in-Chief?
Well, that's a very good question, too. There was a difficulty that not everybody understood. Before Grant's particularly tremendous casualties in 1864, as 1864 began, Grant was quite popular with the Northern public, and he was seen as the victor of Vicksburg and so forth. And so Lincoln wanted to find out whether Grant was interested in being the president, because if he was, Lincoln was in no hurry to make him the general-in-chief and thereby make him even more popular and prestigious. So he sent a an envoy or an emissary behind the scenes to ask Grant how he felt about it, and Grant said he would under no circumstances run for president, and it was just as important that Lincoln be reelected as that the army should win in the field. As soon as Lincoln heard that, then he promoted Grant to be lieutenant general, the first man to hold that rank since George Washington, and brought him east to become commander of all the armies.
How did Grant's popularity with the public help Lincoln in the election?
Well, Grant then became far less popular because those were terrible casualties that Lee inflicted on Grant in the middle of the year. So the best that could be said was, I don't think it was Grant's popularity anymore. I'd say if you're looking for anybody who really sort of saved the day in that election, it was Sherman down south with his success, first going to capturing Atlanta, and then on his way to capture Savannah, although the election actually took place before he got very far towards Savannah.
What about, was in the 19th century, were the elections the same as today, where the vice presidential choice is a big factor in what how people will decide?
Well, that's a very interesting thing, too, because Lincoln dumped his vice president of the first term, Hannibal Hamlin, and Lincoln, who I certainly admire and think was far more good than bad, but he really did Hamlin in. Hamlin had no idea that he was on the way out, and Lincoln sent about six different operatives to the Baltimore Convention, and which did indeed nominate Lincoln, but Lincoln wanted Andrew Johnson and got him, but it was the fix was in, but it was all behind the scenes while Lincoln was publicly saying, I'm standing above the fray, and they must all choose who they want. And one other thing I'd like to say about the elections, which many people don't know, is that it was not a secret ballot. You arrived at the polling place, and you were asked if you wanted a Democratic Party ballot or a Republican Party ballot, and there were two separate boxes. And you asked, in front of everybody who was standing there, you said, I want a Republican ballot, for example, and then you went to the Republican box and dropped yours in, but signed it and dropped it in. So it was not the way it's done today.
How did Lincoln's ability to kind of play politics help him in the election?
Well, he certainly knew how to do some horse trading, but I'd like to shift the question a little bit, if I may. I think what helped him much more than most people realize is that he had a policy of really believing he was the president of all the people. And every day that he was in Washington, which was almost every day of the war, he would set aside 3 hours in the morning to see citizens, and they were admitted to his office from a big waiting room in the order in which they arrived, with no evidence of all that they were more important or less important or poverty-stricken or what it was. And for example, a wounded soldier would come in, and a low-ranking private corporal, and say, Mr. President, I've been wounded, and I was discharged from the hospital. I can't go back to my regiment. I can't get paid. I can't get out of this city, and I'm hungry. And Lincoln, before the man was even able to limp out of the office, would have a messenger on his way over to the War Department, which was on the edge of the White House grounds at that time, with a message to Secretary of War Stanton saying, Secretary Stanton, see that this man is paid. But that got around a lot.
Did the Emancipation Proclamation have anything to do with his popularity, or?
That's a very good point. I mean, very complicated point, but a good point. I think as the war went on, let's say that as the war began, I think most of the North was interested in the idea that the South is not going to secede. The Constitution must remain supreme. The Union must prevail, and we can't have a separate Southern nation. Slavery was definitely on the back burner, I think, at that point. As the war went on, more and more people became convinced that slavery was an equally important issue. And Lincoln did say at one point that if he could preserve the Union, which was he felt that was the most important thing, and there was nothing about preserving slavery in the Constitution or abolishing slavery in the Constitution, but he did say at one point that if he could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, he would do that. If he could do it by keeping them all slaves, he would do that. And if he could do it by freeing half and leaving half in slavery, he would. But what he really was saying was that he had to keep the border states, Maryland, Delaware, Kentucky, Missouri, in the Union. And in our Kentucky, he said, or of our Kentucky, he said, if Kentucky goes, meaning into the Confederacy, I think the game is up. So he waited and waited till he felt that the moment had come to announce that these slaves in the South were all freed legally by his order. And then the irony was that even then the slaves in the border states were not free, but he knew and said repeatedly the only way to really abolish slavery was to have a constitutional amendment abolishing it, and he lived to see that paperwork go forward that ended up in the amendment to abolish slavery.
What effects do you think Lincoln's ultimate victory in 1864 had on both the end and the outcome of the Civil War and then the choice of Johnson in Reconstruction and all that followed?
Well, again, big subject, good question. Had Lincoln lived, I'm sure that we would have had an easier transition with his prestige, with his skill, with his heart and his feelings. I think that Reconstruction would have been quite a different business. When he went to Richmond during the brief time between the end of Appomattox and his being assassinated, he said to the general, the Union general in command in Richmond, he said, let him up easy, let him up easy. And I think that would have been his policy to the South, and I think he would have made that stick because of who he was and what he had accomplished. I don't think anybody could have really if I may use the term, screwed things up the way Andrew Johnson did.
And it seems like Lincoln made the whole idea of let him up easy clear in his second inaugural.
He did indeed. And also, indeed, with malice toward none, with charity for all. I think sublime words, but I think there was a real policy being enunciated there.
Mr. Flood, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
That was Charles Braceland Flood, author of the book 1864, Lincoln at the Gates of History. He spoke with WFPL's Gabe Bullard. Flood will appear at the Filson Historical Society in Louisville Monday night at 6. Talmadge Boston is an attorney based in Texas. He's also a lifelong baseball fan who grew up watching some of the game's greats, particularly during the 1960s and 70s. He's compiled some of those memories and more in a book called Baseball and the Baby Boomer. He spoke to us from his law office in Dallas. What inspired you to write this book and take this particular focus?
Well, I'm 55 years old, which means I'm a baby boomer. And with all the bad stuff that's come down in baseball in the last couple of years about the drugs, I wanted to remind everybody what a great game baseball is and what a rich history it has. So I picked my favorite stories about baseball since World War II and devoted 9 chapters to them, from Jackie Robinson to Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris to Nolan Ryan to Bart Giamatti to Lou Brock to the memoir component of the book about the 7 years that I coached my own son in baseball. So it's really 3 books in one. It's a history book with the rich history of these people I just mentioned. It's a commentary. I talk about the Pete Rose gambling issue in the Giamatti chapter and the steroids issue in the Roger Maris chapter. And it's also a memoir in terms of my personal experiences in baseball and my memoir as a fan of the people who I write about.
Now, you devote a chapter to Mickey Mantle and Jimmy Pearsall. What made you make that particular pairing?
Well, the title of the chapter is Mickey Mantle and Jimmy Pearsall, The Dark Side of Fathers Playing Catch with Their Sons. Both of these guys had overbearing fathers who drove them toward their baseball greatness, but in the process of that driving them, did some serious damage to their personalities. Mantle talked about how when his father died when Mantle was young, he kind of totally twisted off and lost his moral compass and fell into the bottle and alcoholism that was well publicized later in his life. And Jimmy Pearsall had a nervous breakdown that was he wrote about in his autobiography, Fear Strikes Out, that became a very successful movie that was made in 1957 about it. So it's a story of dysfunctional father-son relationships, and that's what they had in common.
I was lucky enough to go to the All-Star game in 1970 in Cincinnati, and the most valuable player play for the losing team was Carl Yastrzemski of the Boston Red Sox, who's also included in your book.
Yeah, my last name's Boston, so I've always been a big Red Sox fan, and Yaz was a star from the time he came up in 1961 until he retired in 83, which means that I cheered for him from the time I was in the first grade all the time until I became a practicing lawyer. His career was that long and that distinguished. And what separated him from, in my mind, was just his incredible passion for the game, going all out every play, every game, every year. He was a blue-collar, lunch-pail guy, and that's why he was beloved, because there was never any question that he was giving everything he had in every game he played. And, of course, leading the Red Sox, who had had, you know, 2 decades of mediocrity, to the pennant in 1967, the impossible dream, really changed the team's fortunes ever since. They've been a first-division team that's been in the playoff hunt, been in the World Series, and finally won a couple of World Series, and it all started in 1967 with Yaz.
Now, you also talk about Lou Brock in your book. Why did you include him?
Well, as a Red Sox fan in 1967, I watched Lou Brock absolutely terrorize the Red Sox and became a fan just because he was such an incredible player and better than anybody in the game at what he did in the 60s and the 70s in terms of hitting for average and getting on base and scoring a lot of runs and obviously stealing a lot of bases. I thought he was the most electrifying, exciting player of his era. And later I got to know him and realized that he is also an exceptional human being. He and his wife are both ordained ministers. They have a Lou Brock Foundation that provides scholarship money in the St. Louis area. He's also a deep thinker, and so my chapter talks about his baseball career, but it also talks about his perspective on baseball and on life,
And he is certainly a worthy role model and was a winner of the Horatio Alger Award a few years ago.
And, of course, you talk about Roger Maris' record-breaking home run season. That really took quite a toll on him, didn't it?
It really did. He was a very private guy. He was from North Dakota. He was about as far away from the big media and the Big Apple glitz of New York as a person could possibly be. And it all just absolutely got dumped on his head when he got in this home run race with Mickey Mantle to try to break Babe Ruth's record. So the limelight was nothing he ever sought. He just wanted to go out and play hard and help his team to win. And Mickey Mantle said that Maris was the greatest all-around ball player he ever saw. He was a great defensive outfielder. He was a great base runner. He slid hard. He made the diving catches. He did everything it took to win the game. And unfortunately, his career didn't quite last long enough for him to have the career numbers to get inducted into the Hall of Fame. But for the baby boomers who were really following baseball for the first time seriously in the early 60s, he was the best player in the game.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation, Bart Giamatti was the commissioner of baseball, of course, died suddenly. You refer to him as baseball's lyricist.
Well, and you know, the lyricist is the guy who puts the words to the music. And if you're a serious baseball fan, you love everything about the game, and it's almost a music and a magic of the game. And nobody ever talked about baseball with more eloquence and passion than Bart Giamatti. And unfortunately, he died young, in large part caused by the stress of the Pete Rose gambling situation. But his words about the game and how it's a metaphor for life and what it means to the American people, in my mind, will live forever.
You mentioned steroids a little earlier, too. Do you think that the records from the steroids era should have an asterisk?
Absolutely. I noticed Cal Ripken in yesterday's paper said that's what he thinks. That's certainly what I think. Obviously, anybody who's hitting home runs with drugs in their body that enhance performance or putting up career pitching numbers like Roger Clemens did with body-enhancing drugs are certainly getting a competitive advantage that their predecessors in the games did not have, and I believe the record book should so indicate, because you got to compare apples with apples, and if they're not the same, well, then let's talk about apples and oranges.
Now, you finish out the book with a memoir of sorts, I guess, a first-person perspective.
Yes, yes. You know, baseball has been the national pastime for 150 years or more because of the generational connection, which obviously passes from father to son to son. And so this was my first-person account of how it's worked in my family and in coaching my own son, who has a strong character and has always had the good sense to be able to speak up for himself. And although he's no longer playing baseball, he's a junior in college, he does love the game, and he looks back on the time we spent together with very good memories. But it's challenging, and there's a lot of bumps in the road, and the father better be listening to his son and being attentive to kind of what's really going on so that it doesn't force him to do something he doesn't want to do, which is exactly what happened in the first chapter with Mickey Mantle and Jimmy Pearsall.
I have a four-year-old who turns five soon, and we'll start T-ball this summer, so I'm looking.
Read chapter 9. That starts with the beginning and kind of goes all the way through until one of the pieces is about the day that my son hung up his glove his junior year of high school. So it'll carry you through that journey, and I hope it's helpful to you.
Great, thank you. Did you play?
I played through high school. I went to the University of Texas, and they have such a great program that if you're not a pro prospect, you cannot play there, and I was certainly never a pro prospect. But I did play through high school, and two out of the last 3 years, I've gone back to the St. Louis Cardinals Legends Camp and played some baseball myself, even in my mid-50s, and love the game as much now to play it as I did when I was a child.
Well, thanks for joining us. Talmadge Boston is the author of Baseball and the Baby Boomer. We appreciate you joining us this morning.
Okay, Rick. Glad to be on your show.
More information about Talmadge Boston and his book is available at our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.